Your Honor, Charles Norton, registration number 10633, appearing on behalf of appellants Radcliffe Properties. May it please the court, the statute, principal statute at issue in this proceeding is section 3112119. The statute can be broken down into a number of discrete elements, and fortunately or unfortunately for the court and for the litigants in this case, the definition of each of those elements is for the most part a matter of first impression for the appellate courts in Colorado. The first element, the landowners of contiguous tracts of land aggregating 5 acres or more located on a boundary of the municipality at the time of the disconnection action may 3 or more years after annexation petition for disconnection. First element then to be noted. This statute pertains only to properties that have been the subject of annexation proceedings in the past. The City of Sheridan has implied or stated in its briefs that this statute could be used as a general mechanism for property owners to disconnect from cities and towns if they are simply dissatisfied with the level of services provided. But the General Assembly has restricted the statute beyond that scope. It only pertains to properties which have been subject to annexation proceedings in the past. The petition for disconnection may be filed if the municipality does not, upon demand, provide the same municipal services on the same general terms and conditions as the rest of the municipality receives. So the next element is that of demand. Defining what is the scope and the nature of a demand. The statute itself does not list elements for demand. We have no case law which defines the element of a demand in this context. We would propose to the court that an appropriate definition or analysis of what's a demand is to think of it in terms of communication by the petitioner, communication by the annexed party, that it wishes certain municipal services to be provided.
Excuse me, counsel. How long does the demand stay alive? If it's done 16 years ago, what's the shelf life of it? Because at some point it seems reasonable to think that the demand has been abandoned.
The right, Your Honor, the right to disconnect remains continuous in our view as long as the city does not provide the services. With regard to the shelf life of the demand, I can't really pinpoint a specific period of time that it should be deemed to expire, but I think this is a case where there was sufficient proof at trial that you don't have to reach that issue, because when the first demand was made, Mr. Montano's demand in 1994, within a very short period of time, the parties had significant discussion, which is reflected in Exhibit Q. It was offered below, had significant discussion about implementing a water and sanitation system in the affected properties. And that got to the point, as you know from review of the record, that got to the point where there was actually specific engineering done. Manholes were identified on the property, likely place to put pipes, likely right-of-way needs were placed on the property. Yield figures were calculated by the engineer. We then move after that process apparently did not consummate in anything in terms of water and sanitation. We then move into the 2000s. The parties talk about the formation of a SID. There are 2 elections to approve ballot questions for a special improvement district in this area. And so there was a continuous effort to try to obtain these services, which we would think, regardless of what sort of shelf life figure you place on a demand, Radcliffe Properties showed its inclination to follow up on the demand and continue to pursue it, and did not at any point abandon it. One point I might also mention, Your Honor, which I hope is responsive to your question about this issue of demand, if a special improvement district had been formed in this area, it would have been under the auspices of the City of Sheridan. The City Council actually serves as the ex officio board of directors for a special improvement district of this type. So here you would have had a form of direct service provision to this area for water and sanitation services at the behest of the appellants in this case, at the behest of the petitioners to disconnect. So at that point, they certainly showed their willingness to pay whatever costs were associated with the services, whether it was a system of special assessment, ad valorem property taxation, or whatever, and to receive them directly under the auspices of Sheridan. That, I think, is a convenient segue to the next element, the one that was perhaps the most heavily contested in the case below: provide the same municipal services on the same general terms and conditions as the rest of the municipality receives. Counsel for Sheridan strenuously argues that this is a finding of fact on the part of the trial court, which is entitled to the requisite deference on review. We would maintain that the facts about water and sanitation service, at least, are not essentially disputed. It was laid out systematically below what it is that Sheridan provides and how it provides it. So the contest about between the two parties with regard to this issue of water and sanitation service resolves itself to a legal question, which is this: if a city chooses to provide a municipal service by contract with another service provider, exercising its statutory power to provide water and sanitation service, for example, and does that by contract, is that providing the same municipal service? Is it to provide that service in the sense of the statute? The city maintains that it has to be in the sewer business in order to be subject to the demands of the statute. It has to physically provide the service. It has to treat sewage. It has to collect sewage. But we would maintain that if Sheridan has made provision for other properties in its territory to receive water and sanitation service by contract, that that is sufficient to meet this test of providing service. And if that is the case, then petitioner has proved their claim.
What about Sheridan's argument that about the lack of infrastructure and who should be responsible for providing that?
Your Honor, you'll notice a couple different fact patterns in Sheridan. First, the city has made arrangements with developers to provide significant water and sewer infrastructure in two developments that are reflected in the record. One is the Santa Fe Industrial Park, the other is the River Point project. That is a very common arrangement. The developer agrees to advance funds for the installation of infrastructure. The city then enters into a contractual commitment with the city of Englewood, which is the sewage treatment entity for this area, enters into a contractual arrangement to maintain that system. Now, Sheridan has the primary obligation to maintain the system, and then in turn, Englewood agreed to physically maintain the system with a second intergovernmental agreement with Sheridan. It should be noted in all these instances, the contracting parties are units of government. They have the statutory authority to provide these services. So Sheridan is the party with Englewood for the treatment of all sewage collected within the city of Sheridan. Sheridan is the party with the city of Denver through its Board of Water Commissioners to provide water service in this entire area. So how infrastructure gets funded, Your Honor, and who has maintenance responsibility can be the subject of contract, it can be the subject of political negotiation. But our contention is that for the purposes of this statute, however that comes about, that the city has provided that service to its residents. And in this particular case, the city has not succeeded. And I might note this is a kind of a no-fault statute. The test of it is, do you have services in place or not? It's not, did you give it a good try? Did you make an effort over the years to try to supply service? Who was at fault for the said process? That's not what's at issue here. What's at issue is, was water and sanitation service provided to this area? And of course, it's uncontested on the record that it was not. Whatever mechanisms the city attempted, whether it was this method of landowner concession and negotiation that was used with the two development projects, whether it is the SID process that broke off in the late 2000s, whatever mechanism was selected, the city did not succeed. And part of our contention in this area is that in this age when funding for municipal improvements is so constricted, and so difficult to obtain. It is to be expected that most cities faced with this situation will attempt to find creative ways of funding infrastructure improvements. The petitioners in this case fully anticipated, and when they supported the SID, in fact invited, charges to be picked up by them to install the infrastructure. They were willing to do that. They made that very clear early in this process. And it's to be anticipated that that's how cities and towns will fund a majority of these projects.
Mr. Norton, let me interrupt you for a minute. So the phrasing in the statute that you're focusing on is on the same general terms and conditions as the rest of the municipality receives.
Right.
And that would include both residential and industrial.
Well, Your Honor, that is an interesting issue. And it's not been the subject of any prior case, to my knowledge.
So let me ask you some factual questions. So with regard to industry in general, does the city of Sheridan, as the record show, the city of Sheridan provides sewage services to all industrial areas?
It shows that it provides it to the commercial areas that I just talked about, John.
Those two commercial areas.
Correct.
Are there any commercial areas that it doesn't provide it to?
Not to our knowledge.
Okay. And residential areas?
The same, Your Honor. The mechanism is different for the residential areas, or at least some of them. There were Title 32 metropolitan districts and water and sanitation districts that were formed to provide service to most of the residential areas, and I believe to some of the commercial as well. They act as the entity to collect the sewage, and then it's treated under the same master agreement with Englewood.
What about the issue that there right now is not the sewage infrastructure, whereas the folks that you're referring to, they built the infrastructure for themselves?
Well, Your Honor, critically, they built it under agreement with Sheridan, and it was dedicated to Sheridan.
So has your client expressed the willingness that it will build the infrastructure and dedicate it?
The SID process means that in part, Your Honor. What would have happened had there been a special improvement district created? When the district was formed, there would be calculations about the budget for the improvements. Bids would then be let. Contractors would construct the infrastructure, and then it would be paid for through a system of assessments against property owners within the area. I think in that particular situation, Sheridan would have played a more active role in the sense that they would have been the contracting party with the contractors who built the infrastructure, but the financial burden would have rested with the property owners.
Hey, Mr. Norton, can't you tap into the Denver water system if you want to?
It's not simply a matter, Your Honor, of pure petition or application by the individual private entity. And this is something we researched in the trial court. Certainly Denver's preference, their strong preference, is for application to be made by the municipal or quasi-municipal entity that has jurisdiction over that area. There have been instances in the past in which private owners have tapped directly. That is a rarity, and it is not the preference under Denver's policy.
But I guess my question goes to the idea of tapping into the system. You're not suggesting that Sheridan should make arrangements for the tap?
Well, Your Honor, they would certainly be, for example, with fire protection, they would certainly be able to do that and could seek a tap for a fire hydrant, fire protection purposes. They could freely do that.
Well, they could, but you're not suggesting that they must in order to provide services to you.
They have to approve the application, Your Honor, certainly for those purposes that we just talked about. Again, I would, in response to your question, Your Honor, Exhibit K is this master connectors agreement or distributors agreement with the City and County of Denver, and it's very clear what the preference is in those documents for planning purposes. Denver contracts with the municipal entity to furnish the supply of water, and then how the collection infrastructure or the transmission infrastructure is created is really a matter of policy from city to city, town to town, district to district. And obviously, we've evolved, if that's the correct word, over the years, from pure municipal service provision, where cities and counties did this themselves, or cities and towns did this themselves, to a system where funding mechanisms primarily have to rest on the shoulders of private parties. But the administrative process through government remains the same.
Thank you, Mr. Norton.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Williamson on behalf of the appellant, or appellee, City of Sheridan and City Council of the City of Sheridan. At council table with me is my associate, Mary Lynn Benham.
Mr. Williamson, I don't mean to get you off track right at the beginning, but I would like for you to comment, if you would please, on Mr. Norton's response to my question about tapping into the Denver system.
Yes, I would characterize the contract a little bit differently than Mr. Norton characterized it. I think what Sheridan has done and what many municipalities do, they don't have a water system, they don't have a domestic water system that they provide to their citizens, but they contract with the City of Denver to allow the City of Denver to serve the cities. And that's not an unusual situation for smaller cities. And the residents have a right to tap into Denver under the contract that's been negotiated by Sheridan, but they become customers of the City of Denver. And that's exactly the case in the City of Sheridan, and that's exactly the case for all of the residents of the City of Sheridan. They're under the same, they have the same rights under the total service agreement with Denver Water as the remainder of the citizens and residents in Sheridan, just as these property owners do. So they're in no different position vis-a-vis obtaining municipal water services than any other property owner or resident of Sheridan.
Sheridan is going to provide fire protection. Why can't they contract to tap into the Denver water supply for that purpose? Shouldn't they provide adequate fire protection, even if it just means tapping into Denver water?
Well, Sheridan does provide water, or excuse me, fire protection. Up until recently, they had their own fire department. Within the past couple of years, they disbanded the fire department and contracted with the City of Denver to provide fire services, although it again is paid for by general tax dollars that citizens pay. When you have a fire at your house in Sheridan, you call a Sheridan phone number and Denver responds. The question I think you're getting at is the location of fire hydrants. And that is certainly a essential component of fire protection, but that's also a component of infrastructure. Typically, when you develop, you have to, the property owner has to bring the fire hydrant in proximity to the developer. And again, that's the case with every developer in Sheridan. If you want to develop your property, you must locate and install a fire hydrant at an approximate or the appropriate location to your property. So these property owners are treated no differently than the remaining property owners in Sheridan. And I guess I'll just jump into the rest of my argument, kind of skip that part and go on to the services. It seems like the focus is on the water and sewer services. And I think the trial court understood what was going on and made some factual findings. And I think that this court should give deference and be bound by those factual findings that, in fact, in this case, this property owner is not being treated differently than any other property owner in Sheridan. If you want to develop your property, you have the services available to you that have been made available through contracts by Sheridan, but the provider is actually a third party. And these property owners and all other developers in Sheridan are under the same constraints. In this particular, in this particular area of town, they're in it's called the Englewood Sanitary Sewer Basin. On the other side of the Platte River, it's in a different basin. And in those areas, there is a special district that takes care of the sanitary sewer needs of the people on the west side of the South Platte River. On the east side of the South Platte River, the sewage flows go directly into a interceptor that's owned by Englewood, and the City of Sheridan has contracted with the City of Englewood to accept these flows. The question is, how do you get the flows into the Englewood interceptor? And as with most other Essentially all other municipalities, if you want to develop your property, it is incumbent upon you to install the infrastructure to transport your sewage to the interceptor. That's exactly what's happened on all of, in all of the development in Sheridan. The two developments that were mentioned by Mr. Norton were a recent urban renewal project called River Point. And in that case, the developer constructed all of the infrastructure. When the warranty period runs, which it has not yet, the infrastructure will be transferred to the city of Sheridan. But the infrastructure was installed and constructed by the developer. And that's exactly the same situation that these property owners are in. If they would like the infrastructure in order to connect to Inglewood, they need to install it. That's no different than any other property owner in Sheridan.
And when they did that, I mean, in the platting, was that all part of the permitting and platting, that was part of the agreement that they would install that?
As far as the River Point?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And so during the time that that Radcliffe has been within the city, have they done anything like that? Have they actually developed the property?
They have not. There's been, my understanding is that there has been no subdivision, no development since they've come into the city.
So how does that compare then with River Point, which was a development that had to go through the process, whereas here they were there when you annexed them, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
So how is it that they're required to develop their property as you describe it?
Well, if they want to further develop their property, they need to have water services and sanitary sewer services. So when they further develop the property, they would at that point be required to install the infrastructure as a part of the development process.
But now
they're not wishing to develop. They just want to have the benefit of the water and sewer services, and in anticipation of development, I would think, but not necessarily. But the fact remains that if they want to avail themselves to the benefits of the sanitary sewer and the water services, then they need to pay for the infrastructure. This is not an expense that should be borne by the remainder of the citizens of Sheridan. It's a cost of development.
Is that a purpose of the SID to finance that infrastructure?
Well, the purpose of the SID is it's really a financing mechanism, mm-hmm, that allows property owners to use tax-free municipal financing to install infrastructure. And it's a quite common financing mechanism. It's done through the municipality, but it is essentially paid for by the property owners, spread out over a period of time. And that's exactly what the city of Sheridan tried to do in this case, and it's something that Sheridan had not commonly done. They had done it in the past on a few occasions, but they spent some $300,000 trying to get this SID off the ground and running. The problem was it became more expensive to install and more complicated than the property owners wished, and they asked the city to stop. The SID was not the only mechanism that the city attempted to used to accommodate the lack of infrastructure in this area. They offered to use their urban renewal powers to assist and finance in providing the infrastructure. And again, the property owners didn't want to do that. I think the bottom line is that the property owners want the city to pay for the infrastructure, and that's not something the city does with anybody. And it's really not a common it's really not done throughout the Denver metropolitan area, and I think there's expert testimony to that effect. Unless there are more questions on the water and sanitary sewer infrastructure, I was going to move on to the other services, although I'm not sure that they're really an issue that's really in question. One of those police and fire, and I believe that the overwhelming evidence was that this property does receive police and fire protection and has ever since it came into the city. There were some issues or evidence regarding roads, street maintenance. And I believe the overwhelming evidence at trial was that although Sheridan doesn't have much money for streets, and Sheridan streets are not in very good shape, West Ridgecliff Avenue is in the category with all of the streets in it, the majority of streets in Sheridan.
So the streets are uniformly bad throughout the city?
Absolutely. And we have a case or a study to prove it. And that's really unfortunate. And of course, when this case came to trial, everybody was in severe economic downturn, and the city was spending $40,000 a year on maintenance of streets. So it was a woeful number, but it was applied evenly throughout the city, so these property owners were not treated any differently. I would like to touch on some of the jurisdictional procedural issues, and I think, Judge Boris, you asked about the staleness of the 1994 demand, and then, of course, that's our position, is that you can't make a demand in 1994 and then act on it some 16 years later. It's my belief that what happened, and I believe there is a continuing right under the statute to initiate a petition, but I think what has to happen is when you give the demand, that starts the clock ticking on the statute of limitations. So your right to disconnect is ripe when you make the demand, and that starts the statute of limitations. After 2 years, if you don't act on that, then you have to go back and start over from square one. And I think that's probably the intent of the statute. I don't think the statute intended to require cities to really be under the thumb or under the threat of disconnection for an infinite period of time just because someone made a demand in 1994.
It seems like the trial court possibly made inconsistent findings about the sufficiency of the demand. It seems like at one point they found that it was sufficient and then later not. Could you address that?
Yes, I can. I think what happened is at the end of the plaintiff's case, the petitioner's case, we moved to dismiss. We took the position that the 1994 demand was not sufficient. The trial court ruled at that time that the 1994 demand was sufficient under the statute, and then the trial court specifically refrained from ruling on whether the statements made by at the 2009 city council meeting were also a demand. That's what happened on the motion to dismiss. At the conclusion of trial, the court ruled that the 2009 statements at city council did not constitute a demand. So I don't think there was an inconsistent ruling by the court. I think the court ruled the 1994 was sufficient, 2009 was not a demand.
Isn't the fact that everyone was negotiating the special district some indication that this developer was following through with the demand, trying to work out some arrangement to provide services to its property?
Well, certainly it is an indication that the property owner wanted services. But I don't think that raises to the level of a demand that you must provide the services or we will disconnect.
Although the statute doesn't describe exactly how that demand is to be made, and I guess what I'm trying to probe is the fact that there apparently was some mutual understanding between the city and this developer that they wanted these services, and you were both moving forward to try to supply them in some fashion.
I wouldn't argue with that. I think that was true, that they wanted the services, and I think the city wanted to accommodate them and get them the services. But I don't think that the fact that they want the services, those services, which are really above and beyond that which is required or which is provided to everybody else in the city, is not a demand that's contemplated under the statute. The other issue that the trial court found was dispositive of this case was the contiguity issue. And I want to briefly touch on that. In this case, there was a stipulation that 8.4% of the property to be disconnected was on the county border. And the court found that was not sufficient contiguity to allow disconnection under the statute. The statute requires that the property to be disconnected must be on the border. I think that's the language of the statute. The cases in Colorado, there's two primary cases, Anaconda, which held that a 3.5% contiguity was not sufficient to allow disconnection. And then the Lakewood, I can't remember, Mastercraft case, held that 21.5% was sufficient contiguity. So I think the implication is that the necessary contiguity is somewhere between 3.5 and 23%. And Anaconda, The court relied heavily upon the relationship between disconnection and annexation. And of course, in annexation, it requires a 16.6% contiguity before you can annex. And we're suggesting, following the Anaconda Court's reliance upon the annexation statute, that that's where you start. And if you have less than 16%, then there needs to be some reason why that would work. If it's more than 16%, then I think the court needs to reason as to why that would be sufficient. In this case, the court heard 3 days of trial and concluded that in this case, 8.4% was not sufficient. I think that is a factual ruling which I think should be upheld by this court. And I see my red light has gone off.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Thank you again, Mr. Norton. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can, of course.